It was labeled the day the music died, the day rock and roll legend Buddy Holly was killed in an Iowa plane crash. Now, federal safety officials are considering re-examining that crash. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also on today's program, we check in with Iowa Public Radio's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell. We'll hear about a new campaign to save the monarch butterfly, an update on some tech issues, including broadband and net neutrality. And we'll hear from David Gallo. He's a pioneer in mapping ocean terrain, who's also helped locate the remains of missing airliners. Buckle up. It's your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's start this News Buzz edition, this Friday edition of our program, off by talking with Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
It's a special week at the Iowa Legislature, a deadline. It's called Funnel Week, a time for bills to make it out of committee if they have hopes for becoming law one day or not, right?
That's right.
Let's talk first about some of the priorities that were present during this session that may be passed.
Well, the governor's priorities look like they're in good shape. He has an anti-bullying bill, which is progressing, a broadband bill, which is progressing, both of which failed to make it through last year, but they look like they're going to make it this year. He proposed some domestic violence legislation, and while his bill did not make it through the committee in the Senate, the governor's office says they're hoping to work with the Senate and get that attached to other bills. And I spoke with a representative for the Domestic Violence Coalition, and they said they were very happy with what got through the funnel this week. So we'll see whether what the governor wants gets attached to that eventually.
Mm-hmm. Was it the controversy over the date for school starting also part of this that's likely to get through?
Oh, yeah. That wasn't on the governor's list of priorities, but there's a real deadline going with that school start date. If the legislature doesn't act, then the Branstad administration is going to get its way. They can deny waivers for schools to start whenever they want. And so there's pressure in the legislature to come up with something, but they're way far apart. One chamber has said, let schools do whatever they want. The other chamber has set August 23rd, or the week in which August 23rd falls, as the school start date. That's right after the Iowa State Fair. So it's really unclear how that's going to get resolved. And also, it's of intense interest to families. You know, they don't want to pay that extra daycare in the summer. They need to plan for camps. Mm-hmm. Schools, I'm told, are coming up with alternative calendars in case this happens. This will be our calendar, and so on. So that's going to have to get resolved one way or the other.
What about some bills that we reported on here for Iowa Public Radio? We heard a number of those that you haven't mentioned thus far. Online schools, they're in education as well, right?
That's a bill that would remove the sunset for the two 100% online schools that are already operating. But there's a lot of especially Democratic opposition to online schools. They see it as competition with public schools, a competition for state dollars. And so this bill would simply, in effect, just lift the deadline and let these two schools continue to operate. So that passed the House. I would be very surprised if the Senate doesn't at least let these two schools continue to operate. But that's a live wire out there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what about something we've talked about on this program, the penalties for marijuana, making those a little bit less?
Oh, yeah. There were two bills in the Senate. One dealt with very small amounts of marijuana, less than 5 grams, and it would lessen the penalties for that. And that bill actually cleared a Senate committee. Who knows what will happen in the House? Senator Steve Sodders, who is a law enforcement officer himself, he's the main backer of these bills. When I said, is there any chance for that to pass in the House? And he said, well, Clell didn't say no. And he's talking about Clell, Representative Clell Bodler, who's a chair of the Public Safety Commission in the House, a sort of outspoken law and order type. So that at least made it through a Senate committee. Another bill that would have done even more, it would have dealt with larger quantities of marijuana with intent to distribute. Also reducing the penalties. They put out information that showed just how many fewer African Americans would be in prison now if it weren't for if these tougher penalties weren't in place. But that one didn't make it through.
Joyce, what about any bills that failed that this is the end of the road for?
Well, there were several that we've reported on. A daycare regulation bill that involved a couple who lost an infant. An infant died in daycare, and that one would have dealt with swaddling and banned swaddling in daycares of a certain size. A very emotional testimony from them, but, you know, reforming daycare is just a heavy lift, and that didn't make it through. We also reported earlier in the session about pesticide drift, small farmers saying that their neighbors who put pesticides on their crops, the allegation is they're not following the rules for how windy it can be, and so the pesticide is drifting onto their or organic crops primarily. There was a bill to regulate that, and that didn't make it through.
Mm-hmm. And finally, some bills that we haven't reported on that have been pretty much under the radar that got through. I'm looking at the list here. It's to do with guns.
Yeah, there's a wide-ranging gun bill, the work of the National Rifle Association, which is, this bill was under the radar, but the National Rifle Association is always at work, whether or not they're making noise about it. But they, in fact, they were very active in the fall campaign. It was on a trip to Western Iowa, saw some very aggressive NRA literature, and they actually defeated a Democratic incumbent. But at any rate, this bill does a lot of things that the NRA wants. Legalizes suppressors. It lowers the age for how old children have to be to own guns. On the other side, and it eliminates privacy for gun permit holders. But the bill has the backing of the police community because it creates a new statewide database of gun permits. Mm. So that would really aid law enforcement. And so it's being touted as a compromise bill. However, Iowans for Gun Safety were not at the table. But it passed the Senate committee that it needed to pass. It will almost certainly pass in the House. And then who knows whether this is going to pass in the end. The Democratic-controlled Senate, Senator Gronstahl says right now he doesn't have consensus in his caucus to bring it up. So we'll have to wait and see on that.
And also a programming note, Joyce, you and I will be talking about this on Monday during our legislative look at the legislature. We'll be focusing on this gun bill this coming Monday on River to River.
Right.
Briefly, before we have to say goodbye, Joyce, the Ag Summit coming up. It's another 2016 cattle call forum for this weekend. Really interesting here. This is going to feature a dozen or so GOP presidential contenders, 7 hours tomorrow before an audience of about 100 or 1,000 rather in Des Moines,
right.
A crush of national media here. What are your observations? What do you find most interesting here?
Well, as you said, 12 candidates, and this is going to be Florida Governor Jeb Bush's inaugural trip to the state. He has some fundraising activity scheduled for tonight, and then he has some additional stops tomorrow, but he will be among those in the summit, at the summit. Chris Christie, Scott Walker, the list is too long to mention them, but because this is Jeb Bush's first trip to the state, and he is, he's going to be a strong contender. And it's reminding me of 2000 when, again, there was a very crowded field of Republican candidates. Steve Forbes, Gary Bauer, Elizabeth Dole, Lamar Alexander, right? Too many to list.
Right.
And they were all actively campaigning. And then George W. Bush entered the race and the waters just kind of parted for him. it's interesting to me that is not the case with Jeb Bush. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that this is a very different Republican Party than it was in 2000. that there's a much stronger conservative wing who are not going to be crazy about Jeb Bush.
Right.
But it'll be fun to see him for the first time.
And also, I heard it called in the press a sort of coming out party for agribusiness leader Bruce Rastetter, who's organized this, the multimillionaire. People outside of Iowa have not heard of him, but perhaps they will much more in the future, organizing this whole thing and also conducting interviews with each of these candidates. So they're
right.
they're not just standing at a podium spouting off for a half hour or so, are they?
Right. They'll be grilled on issues of interest to agriculture, renewable fuels, immigration, water quality, and others. And he'll be on the stage the whole time. Mm-hmm. I actually read some speculation about him eventually running for governor, so we might be getting the cart ahead of the horse there.
All right, Joyce Russell, we have to go, but it's been nice visiting with you. Iowa Public Radio's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell. Thanks. Have a great weekend, Joyce.
Okay, you too.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The monarch butterfly, an iconic species for us here in the Midwest. We all connected with summer in Iowa. In fact, did you know Iowa is the heart of the monarch's breeding range? But if you love monarchs, you've surely noticed not as many of them are dancing across our summer landscape in recent years. Now, though, the Iowa Monarch Conservation Consortium has been established. Joining us now to talk about that, Professor Sue Blodgett, chair of Iowa State University's Department of Entomology, also part of this Iowa Monarch Conservation Consortium. Professor Blodgett, Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Why the decline before we get to the solution that you're aiming for here?
Well, there are several reasons for the decline. One has been, of course, the overwintering habitat in Mexico with issues with deforestation of the place that they all congregate to overwinter. And then also in the breeding area, which Iowa is in the middle of, changes in crop production, changes in pest management, increased urbanization, other changes in land use have all contributed to the decline of the monarch butterfly.
In percentage, can you give us an idea of how big that decline has been? It seems huge when I just think of all the monarchs from my childhood that are no longer there.
Well, they measure the population in Mexico every year because of this congregation, and they look at the total number of acres that that they can see that the monarch takes up. And so I think a recent peak was measured in 1996, almost 45 acres of land that the monarch butterfly was in. In 2014, the last numbers I have available, it was almost 3. Mm. So the decline has been pretty dramatic.
Okay. So what are the goals of this consortium? What do you want to do to turn back the tide here and get our population of butterflies up again?
Well, we're really focused on setting some benchmarks for where we are now relative to both the habitat and the monarch populations for Iowa. And so the immature, the caterpillar, feeds on milkweeds. So we're really focused on milkweed habitats that include milkweed. And a lot of our conservation efforts include milkweeds in the state, which is very fortunate for us, trying to develop a suitable mix of species that of milkweeds and the adult that uses nectar sources, flowering plants. So right now we're developing a fairly simple and we're hoping a fairly economical mix of seed mix that we can use to study this, and also if it works as well as we hope it will, something that we can recommend to people to try out.
So. Okay, so this means, I was just going to say, so get a little corner of the yard and make it into a butterfly garden, including milkweed.
Right, and a lot of, you hear some people talking about we need so many tens of thousands of acres of milkweed. We have looked at some of the literature, and we're not sure that it's measured so much in acres as it is in the habitat that's affected by this monarch plantings. And so the butterfly is quite a strong flyer. It flies to Mexico every year. And so having these patches in our landscape can be as small as a garden type of plot in your yard. So it includes urban dwellers that have gardens, suburban dwellers, and also our rural community.
Okay, we'll certainly check back with you, Sue Blodgett, a member of on this Iowa Monarch Conservation Consortium. Hopefully, we'll have some quick results here. That's what you're hoping for, surely, too, I'm sure, Sue, right?
Yes, we're rolling out quite a program this year, so we're going to be out and about monitoring milkweeds and the monarch butterfly and measuring what impact our efforts are having in the state.
Okay, Sue, we'll check back in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. Bye-bye.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's talk about some tech issues. There's a number of them that have been in the news nationally, also here in Iowa, and here joining us to do that, Matthew Patan is with the Des Moines Register. He's a reporter, covers technology, innovation, the economy, and general business news for the Des Moines Register. Matthew, good afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you in our Des Moines studio. Let's skip through these fairly quickly. We have limited time. Broadband, it's legislation making its way through the Iowa legislature. I heard talked with Joyce Russell about that a little bit earlier. Intended to foster more access to high-speed internet across Iowa. What do lawmakers have in mind? What do they want to produce here?
Well, as the governor made a priority this session, he wanted to basically reach more broadband out into the rural areas of the state. What happened this last week during the funnel was both sides, or last 2 weeks, I should say, the House and the Senate pieces of legislation kind of stripped out the governor's original idea and put in their own. They took out this grant program, released the money side of it, which would have given internet service providers some more money to roll out more broadband networks.
Mm-hmm. So what are the differences? What are the disagreements in this broadband bill?
Well, that grant money was one of the disagreements. It caused some heartburn because there was some concern over where that money would come from in a tight budget year. So basically what they put in now is they have the structure for grant money in case the federal government wants to come in and provide us with any money in the future because, as you said, it's been a big deal at the federal level and there's been a lot of news there as well. They also left in this property tax program, but there's some changes in how long that would last, whether it's 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years.
So some sort of broadband law will get passed to help especially rural Iowans?
That's the idea. Representative Peter County on the House side and Senator Steve Sodders on the Senate side, who are the bill handlers, seem pretty positive about it. Plus, we're not getting held up on some issues that caused us to fail last year. So it seems to be moving ahead.
Okay. Last week, in a 3-2 vote, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, approved new rules regulating broadband internet as a public utility. We know this as net neutrality. So these rules favor this so-called net neutrality online. Help us understand net neutrality and how it may affect us, these new rules here in Iowa.
Sure. So the premise behind net neutrality, and this has been a debate going back at least the last couple of years, between the tech community and internet service providers and telecommunications companies. But the idea behind net neutrality is that all content on the internet should be treated the same. So the most common example is Netflix. So essentially, under net neutrality, Netflix should not have to pay more to get their content out there, and also internet service providers shouldn't slow it down or speed up how quickly you get your video. A couple experts I talked to have, you know, compared it to the highway system. You know, a trucking company shouldn't be able to pay more to be able to go faster on the highway while the rest of us are kind of stuck in the slow lane, to use that term.
Mm-hmm. So what about the claim, though, by the broadband industry that this would harm them or cripple innovation? I don't quite understand that.
Sure. So what the FCC did is they voted, as you said, 3-2 to regulate as a public utility. And it seemed to happen, which what happens with any more regulation is companies come out and say it's going to harm innovation or cause more costs because essentially there's now greater federal oversight over internet service providers. So if you're a consumer and you have a complaint against Mediacom, CenturyLink, Comcast, AT&T, or any of those, you could potentially go to the FCC and say, hey, I have a problem. Can you fix this? So that's one area where the companies are saying that they don't really – need the oversight. The internet's kind of grown on its own without it, you know, so why do something when it's not broken?
Mm-hmm. Will Iowans notice any difference here now that these new net neutrality rules are there?
They shouldn't immediately. If you're watching Netflix, Hulu, or just browsing it on the internet, you'll probably be fine. You shouldn't notice any difference. Any problems you have, you know, you'll still have to deal with your company with. The federal rules still have to go into full effect over the next couple months. And even a couple years from now, I don't think that individual consumers will see a difference because we, as an individual consumer, you are not using hundreds and hundreds of gigs of broadband. But if you're a company, you might notice a difference in what didn't happen.
Matthew Putain, you've been writing about an Iowa City-based startup company that's potentially creating quite a name for it itself. We've had them on the program before. It was some time ago. Pear Deck.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do?
So Pear Deck is an Iowa City startup, and they have this educational tech platform. And the way I understand it is basically if you're a teacher, you can create a plan and use it in the classroom and get some real-time feedback from students so you can basically improve on the go and make it better. And they've been getting a lot of attention recently. They closed a seed funding round at the end of last year. They joined an educational technology accelerator, and then in April they're going to pitch at Google headquarters in California with about 11 other startups as well.
Mm-hmm. And so one of them will pick, or several of them may be picked by Google?
I believe it's not picked by Google. They're pitching in front of a room of investors. So last year, AOL co-founder Steve Case gave basically $100,000 to every single startup that pitched that year. I don't know if that'll happen this year, but I'm sure a lot of people would be happy if it did.
Okay, so Pear Deck, perhaps a household name of the future. We'll have to wait and see about that. Finally, your thoughts, the big news this week, also in the tech world, the growing controversy over Democrat Hillary Clinton's use of personal email for work while she was U.S. Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm. Well, Secretary Clinton's use of the personal email server was, I think, some concern for journalists because she might have skated some open records rules. And whether that comes down or how that comes down, I guess we'll have to wait and see a little bit. But it's interesting that she used a personal server because that's not something that you hear a lot about. I mean, most people aren't using their own servers for email. They usually go to Google or AOL or Yahoo or any other provider because email, as I was talking with Iowa State professor Doug Jacobson about this earlier today, and he said email is basically something that we forget about, and it's not worth putting the time into creating your own server unless you really don't trust what's out there, or if you're just a hobbyist, a tech hobbyist, and you want to build the server on your own.
But the picture that I got from the reports is that this was a server in her home in New York State. So this is a server in a closet that is handling the Secretary of State's email.
It seems so. So you can build your own server, and usually those servers are used for cloud computing or if you really need to start a company. But again, if you're an individual, it doesn't make a lot of sense to put all the work into building the server and taking a computer and getting the software to run it. And especially when you're running email and you're constantly being bombarded by spam or potential phishing attacks, unless you have the entire day to essentially monitor that server and monitor your email, it probably just doesn't make a lot of sense for you to do.
Okay, Matthew Putain, thank you for catching us up on a number of tech issues. Des Moines Register reporter covering technology, innovation, the economy, and general business. Matthew, thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming up in the second half hour, David Gallo, a conversation with him. He's a pioneer in mapping ocean terrain. He's also helped locate the remains of missing airliners, and he'll tell us why, with more than 90% of the ocean floor unexplored, it's so hard to find these wrecks. Also later in the program, it was labeled the day the music died. That was the day rock and roll legend Buddy Holly was killed in an Iowa plane crash. Now, federal safety officials are considering re-examining the investigation into that crash, and we'll hear about that in the second half hour. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest, David Gallo, is one of the first explorers to map the ocean world using both robots and submarines. In 2010, he helped lead an expedition to create the first detailed map of the Titanic wreck. He also helped locate the remains of Air France Flight 447 in 2011 and has appeared in several documentaries, including Why Planes Vanish, which is a look at the disappearance of the Malaysian airline Flight 370. Yesterday, Gallo gave a presentation at the Des Moines Area Community College, the West Des Moines campus, DMAC, on the importance of exploring and understanding the ocean. He joins me now for a few minutes. Dave Gallo, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. My pleasure.
We are in Iowa. You have been in Iowa,
yeah,
at least 1,000 miles from the nearest ocean. Why should Iowans care about what happens in the ocean?
Well, that's what a lot of people think, that we live a long way from the sea. But in fact, the oceans, in a nutshell, they provide us with half of the air you breathe. Here in Iowa, you can thank the oceans for that, 50% of the oxygen. Almost all the rainfall patterns are controlled by the ocean, so the water we drink, and then about 2 billion people on this planet depend on the oceans for food. So, you know, the weather patterns we're dealing with right now, and whether it rains or doesn't rain or snow or doesn't snow, how much, how little, how warm it gets, that's all pretty much controlled by what happens way out in the Pacific. So no matter where you live, the oceans have an influence on you.
Mm-hmm. What are the greatest questions in your mind about our oceans, about our seas, that are still unanswered? What's at the top of the list for you?
Yeah, well, Ben, we know the headlines. The headlines are that we need to understand the oceans because they're constantly changing, and we need to understand what those rhythms, the natural rhythms and cycles are of the oceans, but then we need to know what the human impact is. And things that we thought were okay many years ago are turning out to be not so okay. For instance, if you go to the middle of the Pacific and catch a fish and look in the stomach contents, you'll find micro bits of plastic. If you look at the flesh, you'll find chemicals, the pharmaceuticals, herbicides, pesticides, all the things that we think is great for us, not so good for the ocean. So that's it, is understanding the natural rhythms and then the human impact on those rhythms.
Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere we can go in the planet's oceans where you don't find at least some impact of human presence on the Earth?
Yeah, I've never seen that, man, and I've been in pretty much all of the oceans, but I can even remember being out on Titanic and the first day of coming across the site of Titanic, walking out on deck, and there were all sorts of plastic bags surrounding the ship. It was pretty disgusting, actually, that it came up the Gulf Stream from the east coast of the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's it's getting to be that way, and something we never knew about before, but now we're beginning to understand just how much impact we're having on the sea.
How much of the ocean is unexplored?
A lot. I think we've only had a good look at about 8%, and so there's 92% that's been unexplored, and, 70% of the world is ocean. So when you think about that, we're basically living on an unexplored planet, and when you go to the bottom of the sea, there's mountains, there's rivers, there's valleys, there's waterfalls, there's lakes, there's all the things that we're familiar with on land we find at the bottom of the sea, and they all need to be explored.
Uh-huh. We've gone to the moon. We're thinking about going to Mars. We've explored a lot of places outside of our Earth. Given what you've just said, it makes me wonder why we haven't paid more attention to the oceans.
Yes, in my 30-some-odd years of being in this business, I've always wondered that, is that given what we know, especially now, why we just take the oceans for granted. And I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I think we've done a pretty poor job explaining to the public and the decision makers about why the oceans are important. I think that's part of the equation. We need to do better at that. But not to take anything away from the space stuff. I mean, the space exploration is fantastic, but we should start paying attention to our own home planet for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, take me, at least in radio terms, to the deepest, darkest, most inaccessible part of the ocean. Where is that, or where do you think that is?
Well, I would say probably, in terms of depth, the Marianas Trough. And Jim Cameron, the director of Titanic and Terminator and Avatar, went there by himself in his own home-built underwater spaceship called Deep Sea Discovery. And you start at the surface, no matter where you go. You start at the surface in that lovely colored blue water, the Jacques Cousteau blue, and then as the sub begins to sink, that blue fades to deep blue, then dark blue, and then it's about a 2.5-hour journey to the halfway point in the oceans. For two of those hours are in positive pitch black, and so there's never been any sunlight. It's freezing cold. The pressure is immense, but even in that world, that's hostile to us, we find all sorts of life thriving inside that world. So it's just a dreamlike world once you get below where sunlight penetrates.
What's the deepest you've been in our ocean?
Oh, I'd say 2.5-3 miles, something like that. Somewhere in that vicinity. So that's about the half the ocean depth. Most of the ocean is shallower than that.
Right. I'll shudder on behalf of all of the listeners who just heard that you were 2.5 miles under the ocean. And ask you this, how do you stand not being creeped out, being so deep in the darkness, in a confined space? Is it something you get used to, or something you were fine with from the beginning?
I don't think you ever really get used to it, and I haven't been in the sub in a long time. We've been using robots most lately, but I'm due to get back in the sub, and I'm anxious to find out about whether 20 years older or how I feel about being in a tiny little space with two other people. But I can tell you that even when I was younger, it is a daunting experience to be in there for 10 hours in that tiny little titanium bubble, but what's going on outside the sub just takes all that away. It goes by incredibly quick because everything you see outside the window, it's probably the first time and maybe the last time anyone has ever seen that landform or those kinds of animals.
You spent a lot of your career looking for lost things. I mentioned the flights, also Malaysian Airlines, the Air France flight that crashed in 2009 that was located in 2011. Why is it so hard? What is the real trick of finding something under the ocean? It seems to confound at least people who listen to the news that these things can't be located.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at how little people, we have to rediscover the oceans, that it's not a big blue fishbowl, that it's an unexplored world. And yet at the bottom, there's the world's highest mountains, the deepest valleys. It's a very, there's earthquakes, volcanoes. It's just not what people think. And it's deep. The average depth's 2 miles. So when something sinks to the bottom of the sea, it's going into a totally unexplored space. And it might as well in some ways be on Mars, except for Mars you can actually see at the bottom of the ocean. There's absolutely no light, so you've got to bring your own light. So everything is slow, and ships only go 10 miles an hour, so if something sinks in the middle of the ocean or disappears there, it takes a week or more just to get out there. There's precious few tools. That we need special robots and submarines and all that, and there's not a lot on this planet. There's only a handful that can go into the deep ocean. And, it always amazes me that even today, when something sinks into the deep sea, we would commit the ship or plane and the souls aboard it for eternity to the deep. And now with our technology, we've crossed that boundary. So no shipwreck is beyond our reach anymore. But this thing called eternity, we cross that boundary. So it makes, when we do that, we go with a lot of respect for something like a shipwreck or a plane at the bottom of the sea. But the reason we get involved is because we have expertise of working in those worlds. There are very few people on the planet that have that kind of expertise, but it fits what we do. And it's important, I think, for the families of the victims of those disasters, planes or ships, and for the, in the case of airplanes, for the flying public as well, to find those planes and figure out what happened, why they ended up at the bottom of the ocean.
Dave, what's your big next exploration on the horizon?
Looking at a couple of them, of ships lost in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. But I think we're also looking at Shackleton's ship in Antarctica, that Ernest Shackleton lost his vessel in 1918 in Antarctica. But I think for me, I want to concentrate more on the communications point of view, is that given what we know today about how important the oceans are and how unexplored they are, how do we get that message across? So I'm going to spend a little bit more time in the next couple of years thinking about the communications aspect, about how to bring this story home.
I understand that you describe yourself, David Gallo, as a horrible student growing up. Mm-hmm. What was the problem? How old were you when you were having problems?
Oh, I think all through school. If I go back and look at my report cards, and it was one of my most horrific days when my sons found my old report cards, and all C's and occasional B, but not and many D's. I had ADD. I only found that out because my kids were tested about 10 years ago, and I found out that I have ADD. So I think that was the issue. And so I found it really hard to pay attention in class. Even though I had this burning desire to do science, to be a scientist, my teachers and my guidance counselor said, you don't have a chance. And, you know, it was pretty, in one moment, in one sentence, they were able to crush that whole passion I had. And so that's what I believed for many, many years, that I just didn't have the aptitude to do this.
Right. And you grew up in a time when ADD wasn't on the tip of everyone's tongues. So
right.
what help did you get, or did you get any?
No, I never got any help. In fact, what I grew up with the stigma that I never worked to ability, and I disturbed others. So it was horrible, you know. And I have to tell you, truthfully, I'm probably the same way now in meetings. I don't think I've changed. I'm still, still the same person. So
you're not a favorite in meetings?
No, it's all. Everyone always says, "Oh, great, we're going to spend the next hour looking at Dave's iPad."
So doing that poorly in school, getting those bad grades, where was the breakthrough? When was your learning passion ignited so that you could be productive?
It was in the middle of my experience of selling shoes. I did that for 7 years in a local mall in Albany, New York, and I picked up a National Geographic, and there was an article by Bob Ballard. I was in my mid-20s, and that article rekindled my interest in exploration. And I went to it all started with a community college. That I went to a community college, and it was a different sort of experience for me. And the people, the teachers were interested, and the other students were just like me. And from there, it was 2 years that I really put my mind into it, got my bachelor's, got my master's, and then at SUNY Albany, State University of New York at Albany, and then got my PhD. But the important part was I didn't get smarter. I just flipped that switch of curiosity and ended up, just working really hard to make it all happen. Mm-hmm. So,
as a fan of National Geographic magazine, you have probably seen the latest issue. It's sitting on my coffee table at home. I haven't had a chance to get into it, but I did see the cover. An issue dedicated to the various facets of what is termed the war on science. I want to ask you in closing, why do you feel many reasonable, intelligent people doubt science and that process?
You know, Ben, I don't know. And what I try to do, because, again, you know, people sometimes tell me you have a great way of breaking it down for the normal person, but I'm careful saying I'm normal, but, I talk the way I talk. And the conversations I've had with some of the people that doubt science, we seem to come away from that okay. I blame sometimes the media and some scientists that want to make science above humanity. And to me, that's just foolishness, because it's things that we live with every single day. So I think it's a communications issue. And I think once people can get someone to speak to them in normal terms, tell me what's going on, what do you know, what don't you know, what do I need to know, things can be okay. But we're a long way from that. So we've got this real movement growing that science is necessarily not great for humans.
David Gallo, one of the best-known explorers of the ocean world. He visited Iowa this week, the Des Moines Area Community College in West Des Moines campus of the DMAC. And David Gallo, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you, Ben. My pleasure.
It was labeled the day the music died. That was the day in 1959 that an airplane crash near Clear Lake, Iowa, killed rock and roll legend Buddy Holly and three others. After an investigation in 1959, the Civil Aeronautics Board ruled that the crash's cause was pilot error and deficiencies in the weather briefing to the pilot. But now, 56 years later, officials with the National Transportation Safety Board say its cold case unit is considering reopening the investigation. Joining us to talk about that, Gary Moore, author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. Gary Moore, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So the circumstances of the crash and the investigation into it, go into that quickly. We have about 5 minutes.
Well, you know, the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board, which was the predecessor to the NTSB, they did a good job of examining the crash. There's a lot of documentation that's been preserved, and I will be surprised if the NTSB actually does reopen the case, because there hasn't been any new evidence that's presented. In my book, Hey Buddy, I worked with the NTSB, and we present the most detailed written account of what happened that night that's ever been published before. And our conclusions I guess the path that we took to get to the same conclusion that the CAB came to at that time, which it was absolutely pilot error, period, were a little bit different. But you had an inexperienced pilot who had failed his instrument rating exam, was flying in instrument conditions in a high-performance airplane with a heavily weighted plane, and no one should be surprised that it ended in disaster.
Do you know who is bringing forward this request to reopen the investigation?
He is a pilot and an airplane dispatcher, is what I've read. He's not speaking to the press, and I'm sure he's well-intentioned and a very bright guy, but he's not. He hasn't presented any new evidence, and so seems to be a defense of the pilot. He has stated that the pilot acted heroically in trying to save the plane, and I don't think anybody disputes that. I'm sure the pilot tried to save the plane. He was trying to save himself and the pilots, or the occupants. But still, when you look at most of these small plane crashes in the United States before 1959 and since then, it usually involves an inexperienced pilot and bad weather. And that's exactly what happened that night.
Okay, so your conclusion in your book and after your research is pretty cut and dried. Inexperienced pilot, pilot error here. There are some other theories swirling around out there. What are those?
Right. Well, the other theories that are swirling around, you have the ones that, I mean, the Dwyer family, Jerry and his wife, through the years, they have said that that they have the plane, they have evidence that something different happened, and they were going to tell the truth, and they're going to write a book. And I don't believe any of that's true. I don't even believe they have the plane. They've never shown it to anybody. They've never produced it. And a man in Waterloo, Iowa, claims that he drove the dump truck that carried the plane to the Mason City dump. And so so I don't believe there's evidence there. There's this conspiracy theory or the theory that Buddy shot the pilot. Well, the only occupants of the plane, the only witnesses are all dead. There was an autopsy performed. The pilot didn't have a bullet in him. The gun that was found at the crash site had one spent cartridge, but the farmer, the man by the name of Jewel, who found the gun, says that when he picked up the gun, he shot it in the air. So it's ludicrous to give any weight whatsoever to the idea of the gunshot or the pilot being shot.
Well, yeah, the gunshot. What would be the motivation there to shooting the pilot?
Yeah, I mean it was crazy. The flight lasted 5 minutes, and the witnesses said that when the occupants boarded the plane, they were all in a good mood. So something horrific would have had to happen to make Buddy Holly, who is everybody who knew him said he's one of the nicest people on the face of the earth, pull out a gun and shoot the pilot. So, I mean, that's silly.
Yeah. Remind us, what was the weather that night?
The weather was low visibility. It wasn't poor visibility. It was low visibility. There were snow showers. And if you've ever sat in the cockpit of a single-engine airplane, that's going 120, 130 miles an hour, a little bit of snow, it looks like you're sitting in the Millennium Falcon going warp speed. I mean, the snow can be blinding. And so the pilot obviously became disoriented. The plane has a high-performance airplane like that with a single prop. It's going to naturally torque to the right. And if you lose the horizon, you lose your sense of direction, that plane's going to tip over on its side, which it did. It's going to pull into a spin. It's going to strike the ground right wing first, which it did. It's going to cartwheel, to the resting place, which is exactly what happened. It's very, very easy to trace what happened to the airplane. What we don't know, and nobody can ever prove, is why it happened. And, the pilot should not have been behind the controls of that airplane with lack of visibility. He was not instrument rated.
Gary Moore, thank you very much.
Pilot error. Thank you.
Author of Hey Buddy, and talking about the possibility of the National Transportation Safety Board reopening the case, a cold case into the investigation of Buddy Holly's plane crash in 1959.
I hear the beat of the drums coming out of the door. I've heard it many times, but I come back for more. So I step inside and have a seat at the corner of the bar.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Finally today, we round off the hour with the music of a fantastic Iowa artist who's been thrilling audiences over the past decade with his own catchy original tunes. Damon Dotson grew up in Northwest Iowa. He now lives in Des Moines. This afternoon at 2 o'clock, he'll be performing live at the Java House in downtown Iowa City as part of Iowa Public Radio's Java Blend series, which I host. If you're in the Iowa City area, why not stop by, say hi, and catch the performance? Here's a new song Damon just wrote called Matthew Street, an actual street connected with early Beatles history.
Been in my teens when I was growing my roots and started to believe you could do anything. So I slept every night singing to the crowd. You're singing, oh, oh, this is Matthew Street. It's where it all began for me.
Iowa artist Damon Dotson. He'll be performing this afternoon at 2 at the Java House in downtown Iowa City as part of Iowa Public Radio's Java Blend series. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Also thanks to Julia Davis. We had help today from Jason Burns in Ames. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Feel the beat of the drums coming out of my heart. I felt too many times just before I started, and it won't be long now. And I'll be singing out loud. Because